In the summer months, we follow the fortunes of Gloucestershire Cricket Club. That's all wrapped up with the best music mix on Sports Saturday, 3 till 6 with me, Paul Davis, on BCFM 93.2.
Tune in to Fiwi Sinting with me, Hilary, every Thursday afternoon for your weekly dose of the Caribbean.
Steve, you know what this is, don't you? It's a time-space warp.
I know exactly what that is.
I don't suppose anybody really does. We've seen some strange things tonight. Strange creatures that we know don't belong on our planet. God only knows where they came from.
Jenny and Beth.
The vortex took them. Just took them away.
Back to BCFM's politics show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The organ harvesting scandal you haven't heard of, and why might that be? Which nation is responsible for this kind of evil? Not Russia, I'll give you a clue. The Gulen movement, what is it? Former CIA agent Paul Williams spoke to Sean Stone on RT America recently all about the Gulen training camps for jihadis inside the US, how it links through to our very own European Operation Gladio in the 1980s, where NATO's secret military intelligence cells were blowing us up, innocent civilians all over Europe, and blaming it on the Soviets. And is Lebanon hacking our smartphones so they can use them as microphones to spy on us? That's, on the face of it, a ludicrous fake news which has been circulating the globe today. Is it even possible? And the latest edition of the BBC's House of Saud series by former Conspiracy Files producer Mike Rudin. Is this a brave new investigative journalism breakthrough out of the BBC mould? Or just even more sophisticated propaganda? Our sister show Dialects back here at BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can be sure to catch it online. This week we hear from the Grenfell Tower Action Group's Joe Delaney. A full interview with him. We had a little part on this show last week. And on there, you can also hear an interview from one of the actresses from the BBC's 1979 and 1980 20 million viewers an episode Shoestring series filmed in Bristol. The full two series is just out for the first time on DVD after 40 years. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Anyway, Martin, we'll start with this horrific story about organ trafficking. The Israeli organ trafficking network Kingpin has been arrested in Cyprus after a decade on the run. This was being reported about a week and a half ago. I've only just come across it. Fascinating. Reuters has been reporting on it, etc. But really no reporting of anything in the British news about it. An Israeli man who allegedly headed up an international organ trafficking operation has been arrested by police in Cyprus. Moshe Harel stands accused of leading the network, which is said to have operated in the Balkan state of Kosovo around a decade ago, along with his associates. Police claim he lured potential donors from countries across Eastern Europe and Russia and Turkey and Central Asia before removing their organs and leaving them with no medical aftercare once operation had been carried out.
Well, I mean, this has been going on for many years. Most people don't realise it, but poor people all over the world are preyed upon by these kind of criminals. And, you know, there is a market. We were talking about marketisation of the health service in the first hour. There is a market for these organs. And it's, you know, literally poor people are having organs ripped out of their bodies and they are then sold on at a profit to wealthy people. It's as crude as that.
Donors received as little as 12,000 euros in exchange for one of their kidneys, which would then be sold to wealthy recipients for nearly 10 times that price. So that's 120,000. It's quite a good markup, isn't it? 90%. The majority of recipients who bought organs from the trafficking gang were Israelis, according to the prosecutors. It's been claimed some donors never even received payment once their organs had been removed. Commenting on Harold's detention, police spokesman Baki Kelani said, based on an international arrest warrant, the suspect MH was arrested a few days ago in Cyprus. He's been wanted in a person since 2010. So he's been on the run for around about 8 years. This is Interpol, effectively, that have done this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad that he's been caught. But, of course, I mean, we're pushing in this country towards the idea that when people die, that their organs should be, unless they've opted out, their organs should be available to the health service to be provided to others. And I think that's probably the right policy. But
surely people should be given the choice to opt in if they want.
Well, no, that's been the previous policy. But yeah. The Welsh Assembly has agreed that, and this is the talk is of this.
I mean, surely you have a presumption that the person themselves should decide this, not the health service.
No, you can opt. I think it's better to have an opt out. If people want to opt out, it shouldn't be compulsory. But the problem is, unless you're going to go into the illegal market to buy organs, there is insufficient organs to be transferred under the National Health Service. It's like blood donorship.
So is this just a simple thing of demand and supply? Just like
It shouldn't be based on market criteria at all. I'm perfectly happy for people to take my organs if I die in a car accident, and if they're useful to somebody, that they should be used.
Well, you can get yourself a kidney donor card.
Well, indeed, but I mean, the point is, Tony, that they're moving towards, and it's already happened in Wales, you can opt out, but if you don't opt out, then your organs are there to be used by the health service, not to make a profit for this kind.
Back to this Israeli network. Harold is said to have led a gang of 9 people who rang the trafficking network out of a clinic in a residential area of Pristina. Lufti Dervishi, the director of the clinic, was jailed alongside his son Arban for their parts in the conspiracy in their absence in 2013. They were handed sentences of 8 and 7 years respectively for their part in the network's activities. Both men went into hiding and have yet to serve their jail terms. Sentencing the men at the time alongside 3 others, Judge Dean Pinellis said their victims lived in extreme poverty. They could not speak the local language and had little idea what was happening to them, and nobody to look out for their interests. But this is quite clearly, there is an Israeli end to this as well, which is what bothers me. We're being told that Israel is a democracy, and yet people are having stolen organs transplanted into them in Israel.
Yes, but I think it's not just Israelis who are involved in this evil trade. I mean, in Latin America, it's been going on for years. I think the problem is the marketization of human life, which is implied by all of this, is the real problem. That's why we've got a National Health Service which isn't based upon financial criteria, in theory.
So, yes, between 80,000 and 100,000 euros, is that about the price of a kidney?
Well, I don't know, because I've never bought one. But, I mean, if you think back to the scandal of blood donors in the 1980s, where the Tory government of the era decided to buy blood from the United States, which all turned out to be infected, because the people who sell blood are people like people addicted to drugs and so on, selling blood to make money. And, of course, loads and loads of people were given blood products which were infected. And, of course, if you're going to have people giving blood as a donation, you can't at the same time say, well, other people are going to sell their blood. So it's one or the other. You either have a market-based system where people sell blood, or you have a system where people voluntarily give blood or organs or whatever, and it's not based on any kind of financial criteria.
Do you want to guess how this scandal came to light? The organ scandal came to light in 2008 when a Turkish man was stopped at Pristina Airport, visibly in pain, having just had his kidney removed. The trafficking ring acted out of the Medisus clinic on a residential road on the outskirts of Pristina. How do we stop this sort of thing, Martin? Because this guy's been on the run, everyone else it seems has been on the run, and yet this particular chap, Moshe Harold, in in Cyprus. But it seems that, I mean, surely the EU should have a role here in making sure that, you know, any countries which are within the European Union have the, you know, some sort of effective policing to stop these people travelling.
Well, Kosovo isn't part of the European Union as yet. And of course, Kosovo is a failed state.
Cyprus. Like many other what about Cyprus?
Well, Cyprus, it's been Cyprus that he's been arrested because it's not quite a failed state. But the fact of the matter is that poor people all over the world in desperate circumstances will either A, sell blood, or B, if under certain circumstances, sell their organs because they're desperate. And we've actually got to actually move towards, as I say, a non-market-based healthcare system which isn't based on financial criteria.
So, what about the next story, which is Lebanon hacking our smartphones? What do you make of that one?
Well, I'm surprised. Who in Lebanon? Why Lebanon? I mean, we all know that phones can be hacked, but why are the Lebanese in the frame for this?
It's intelligence, Lebanese intelligence services. They've been turning targets' Android phones into little spy phones. That's at least according to the Financial Times, Reuters, The Telegraph and The New York Times.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we all know that electronic equipment is not secure and that the National Security Agency of the United States virtually watches everybody using their phones. And if the Lebanese intelligence services are also engaged in this, it wouldn't surprise me. But I can't see why the Lebanese in particular have been picked on here. And in actual fact, of course, there are different forces at work in Lebanon. You know, it's not even clear what the, you know, the state's actually quite fractured. So you're not, you know, who are we talking about here? And this is, you know, it seems...
Okay, the people reporting this are, it's basically saying Lebanon's internal intelligence agency, because what they're saying is effectively that it's generally only state-level intelligence services that have got the ability to do this kind of thing. Although,
well,
I
exactly, but why pick on Lebanon when we know that the United States and Britain, we've got GCHQ just up the road here. What do you think they spend their days doing? They spend their days hacking people's phones. But of course, we're pointing the finger at the Lebanese as if they're the evil kind of...
Anyway, what the New York Times is saying is that Lebanon's internal intelligence agency appears to have been caught spying on thousands of people. Well, appears to, including journalists and military personnel in more than 20 countries, according to researchers at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Lookout, a private mobile security company. The spy operation apparently is among dozens around the world uncovered by human rights groups and technical organisations. Now, this is the EFF, which, you know, I suppose once upon a time it was quite good, but it doesn't really now seem to be, you know, making much sense. This story doesn't make much sense to me. And he's saying, and he's basically saying that this is a pressure group plus private internet security firm based in the US that's saying this.
Yeah, well, I think the fact of the matter is that Lebanon is in the firing line for regime change. That is definitely what's been going on. That's why Rafiq Hariri was summoned by the Saudi prince to justify his behaviour and so on. And because of the fact that in Syria things aren't going the way of the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Western powers want.
The Frontier Foundation call themselves the leading non-profit defending digital privacy, free speech and innovation. And they're actually sometimes quite critical of the NSA.
Well, I mean, they should be, because the NSA, quite clearly, is the biggest organisation on the planet which is involved in this kind of stuff.
Just take us once more through the motives that the NSA might be trying to frame the Lebanese, and how might they be doing it?
Well, it's not the NSA, it's the Americans, or the US, and the British, and the Israelis, and the Saudis. Lebanese, they're not very happy with the state of the situation in Lebanon, because Hezbollah are in the government. Hezbollah are aligned with the Christian community. Rafiq Hariri is a representative, as it were, of the Sunni community in Lebanon, which is the biggest community but not the majority. And you know, after the civil war in Lebanon, it's quite a delicate balance to keep everybody's interests represented in the central government. And the Israelis are very hostile to the Lebanese government, precisely because it does have Hezbollah as part of that, a part of the government. And I think we've got to watch out, because there's quite a possibility that the intelligence service, Western intelligence services, and the Saudis are attempting to foment civil war in Lebanon, and therefore the Lebanese secret service are probably taking their own steps to try and prevent that. And of course, they're then being singled out for being terrible people for spying on people's phones. I mean, that's what intelligence services do. That's what GCHQ does. And of course it's not right, and there ought to be safeguards and so on and so forth. But why pick on the Lebanese? What about, what do you think the Saudis do all day? Do you think they sit there, not it's only the Lebanese that spy on people's phones? It seems a bit odd to me.
Abu Hamza said he was, this is another story, Abu Hamza says he was tipped off about 9/11 4 days before the attacks. Hate preacher Abu Hamza said he was tipped off about 9/11 4 days before the horrendous terror attacks on New York City. This was the Express on Monday. The hook-handed former imam from Finsbury Park claims he received a phone mail from terrorists in Afghanistan who told him something will happen very soon. The revelation comes from court documents as the 59-year-old is launching an appeal claiming conditions in the Supermax prison in Colorado where he's being held breach his human rights. Hamza also claims British spies were hacking his phone at the time, raising questions as to whether the UK was withholding information from America. The court documents seen by the Sunday Times also reveal Hamza was an agent for MI5 and Special Branch, going by the code name... Do you like to guess his code name? No. Damson Berry.
Well, there we are. You see, and Abu Hamza, who was broadcast all over the British media as this evil imam with a Captain Hook and all the rest of it. And it turns out that he was working for MI5 all the time.
And Special Branch.
And Special Branch. And, of course, he infiltrated Finsbury Park Mosque, caused all kinds of troubles for the authorities in the mosque there. And, of course, he was actually working for the state. And, of course, it's not really a secret. Everybody knows that Al-Qaeda, for example, who are under attack in Idlib as we speak from the Syrian army, is Al-Qaeda, and they're supported by the British, US and Saudi state. They always have been. There's nothing new about this. And, of course, that's underlying everything. The so-called Sunni, Wahhabi, Salafi terrorists are tools of Western states. Meanwhile, we're banging on about how the Lebanese Secret Service are trying to spy. Presumably the Lebanese Secret Service is trying to spy to find out what the hell these other people are
The reason that he's complaining is because he's not allowed fresh air, and even when he does get occasional fresh air, he's kept in a cage away from other inmates, presumably because so he can't discuss anything with them after being a British agent. What do you think the actual... I really like to guess what sort of things would have been going on between Special Branch, MI5, and Abu Hamza in the run-up to the London bombings?
Well, the fact of the matter is that they create... he was used very much to create the image of Muslims as being crazy people and all the rest of it. And of course, Abu Hamza's right-hand man, Harun Aswat, was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind of 7/7, had been on the phone to all four alleged bombers in the week before the attack. But of course, what they've done with Hamza and with Harun Aswad is they've magicked them away into their secret detention
to the US
facility. That's right.
So they're outside British jurisdiction.
We can't have a trial. And of course, if Hamza came to trial for being involved in 7/7, I was involved in 7/7, but I was working for the British state all the time.
Say, for example, Graham Fawkes, who we had on this show a few weeks ago, who lost his son in the 7/7 bombings, wanted to bring a private prosecution against Abu Hamza or against Harun Aswat. The courts would just throw up their hands and say, sorry, he's outside our jurisdiction.
Well, this is the whole problem with their non-legal breaking of habeas corpus and just putting people into legal limbo as suspected terrorists who can be just locked up indefinitely. And people say, well, I don't want these people running around. Somebody needs to lock them up. But the fact is, what they do is they're protecting the secret services of the West from from being investigated for what they've been doing all along, which is actually orchestrating Salafi terrorism. We are allies with Saudi Arabia. Their chaps are all trained at Sandhurst. Our military are over there at the minute. There are RAF personnel. There are people from the Scottish regiments working over there. They are our close allies. And we worked with them to try and turn Syria into a graveyard. And that's what we've been doing over the last 5 and 10 years. And there's no dispute about it. That's what's been going on.
One of the stories I missed over Christmas, apologies, folks, should have really been doing that last week, or the week before, but was on The Intercept, which I would suggest everyone bookmarks. It's a fantastic, excellent. It's where the Edward Snowden leaks first came from over in Brazil. And Glenn Greenwald was writing there on the 30th of December last year a story saying Facebook says it's deleting accounts at the direction of the US and Israeli governments. In September of last year, we noted, he says, that Facebook representatives were meeting with the Israeli government to determine which Facebook accounts of Palestinians should be deleted on the grounds that they constituted incitement. The meetings, called for and presided over by one of the most extremist and authoritarian Israeli officials, pro-settlement Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, came after Israel threatened Facebook that its failure to voluntarily comply with Israeli deletion orders would result in the enactment of laws requiring Facebook do so upon pain of being severely fined or even blocked in the country. The predictable results of those meetings are now clear and well documented. Ever since, Facebook has been on a censorship rampage against Palestinian activists who protest the decades-long illegal Israeli occupation, all directed and determined by Israeli officials. Indeed, Israeli officials have been publicly boasting about how obedient Facebook is when it comes to Israel censorship orders. And this, just to quote one of them, shortly after news broke early this month of the agreement between the Israeli government and Facebook, Israeli Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked said Tel Aviv had submitted 158 requests to the social media giant over the previous 4 months, asking it to remove content it deemed incitement. She said Facebook had granted 95% of those requests.
Well, I mean, these big tech companies, which were basically set up by the CIA, effectively, are being used very, very much so in 2018. We can see the totalitarian direction of travel of what's going on. People used to think that the internet was a place where you could get all sorts of opinions and find out what people thought about things. But Ahed Tamimi, the 16-year-old that was still in prison for supposedly slapping Israeli soldiers, said they've taken down her Facebook because they don't want her to communicate to the world at large about what's going on there. And I think we've seen an increase in censorship from all of these organisations in recent months. And this is because, as we've discussed off air many of the time, we're possibly moving towards World War III, and therefore they need to have much tighter control over the means of communication before the balloon goes up.
And what about the potential of that World War III to be sparked in Israel or around that part of the
world?
And
the Middle East in general is the most likely place for it to start. But of course, the problem is we've also got Southeast Asia on tenterhooks as well.
I suppose you know in a way you have to do that censorship in order to create massive tension between different parties in order to get a war going. This is what the Israelis call conflict initiation.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that they've been pushing very strongly to try and the algos that Google are using now is derating lots of alternative news sources. The whole stuff about fake news, fake media, Russians fixing elections all over the place. It's a huge propaganda barrage, so that they can then claim that anybody, people like us, that criticise what they're doing. People shouldn't be allowed to listen to us because we're clearly inciting and so on and so forth.
Facebook deleted David Icke's Facebook page, but it was restored 6 days after it was what they call unpublished. 6 days in which Facebook apparently ignored the requests. Facebook called it an error. And I'm sure, says Andrew Cheatham on the davidicke.com website, everyone will believe them.
Well, I think what happened there is they overplayed their hand. I mean, Icke, I don't particularly agree with Icke, but he's got many people who follow him. And then Facebook declares him an un-person, and people are immediately suspicious. I mean, how can you declare somebody like that, who's a public figure with loads and loads and loads of people following their pronouncements, and then just declare that they don't exist and you can't hear them anymore? This is the problem all censors have always had. Once you start censoring things, people say, well, I want to listen to that. I don't agree with David Icke, but if somebody wants to shut him up, I want to hear him.
Zero Hedge is a website which was called Fake News originally by Obama and Clinton and all that original stuff that we heard just a few days after Google had launched their anti-fake news app. Mm-hmm. You know, that then you saw, actually, no, it was Barack Obama and Angela Merkel, I think, that announced the whole anti-fake news campaign for Google. You have to imagine that that's what they're doing over in Germany a year before last, November, I think it was. Anyway, one of their stories this week, of course, must be fake news because we're told that it's not official government approved news, is that China's official military newspaper is warning war is not far. This is regional situations around China are complex and unstable. Dangers are hiding under the peace. China cannot afford a military failure, so we must be fully aware of potential crisis and prepare for battle at all times. When the country is on the brink of becoming a great military power, it's also stepping into a period with high risks to national security. This is an official of the People's Liberation Army wrote in the People's Liberation Army newspaper. The article first headlined last week at the PLA Daily, "A soldier without desire for war preparedness is not a good soldier." The newspaper warned that Chinese soldiers are not ready for combat because many refused to believe that war is imminent. Military experts agree the threat of conflict around China has increased massively in recent years.
Yes, I mean, and how can anybody claim that zero hedge by reporting what the People's Liberation Army of China have made as a public statement are putting out fake news? It's a fact that the PLA have said this in their own newspaper. That's an official Chinese government
position. They're saying war is not far away. That's what they're saying.
Yes, well, Tillerson...
I mean, surely they're Tillerson just trying to wind Trump, up their troops
Tillerson,
to get them
yes,
ready.
Well, of course, but Tillerson and Trump this week have been saying, both of them, that there's probably no peaceful solution in Korea. Now, in actual fact, there's no military solution in Korea, so they shouldn't be saying that at all. There is no military solution, but they're saying that it's quite possible that there's no peaceful solution. Now, if there is a military strike on North Korea by the Western powers, probably including the RAF, for example, and the Royal Navy, then the Chinese have already made their position clear. They will fight back on the side of the North Koreans. So all this stuff about whether North Korea has got a missile that can hit the United States or not is irrelevant, because if you go to war with China, they definitely have got missiles which can hit the United States. So in other words, we're talking, if we don't go nuclear, we're going to have a conventional war in Korea, but the Chinese will be fighting with the North Koreans against the West and against the United States. But I think the one useful and quite hopeful thing that's happened is that the North Koreans and the South Koreans have decided to open negotiations with each other in a very tentative way. And of course, the Americans just had a meeting to try and isolate North Korea, where they didn't invite China or Russia, and they are attempting to try and recreate the coalition that fought the Korean War in the 1950s. And of course, if we have a Korean War, which won't necessarily be a nuclear war, the Chinese are much closer to Korea than the United States or Britain. And if there's a non-nuclear conventional war in Korea, the Chinese People's Liberation Army will win. They will. There's no doubt about it. And I think that the Americans have never won a war since World War II, not even one, unless you include things like Grenada, and they will get a bloody nose, and they will deserve one if they start
it. In the background to all of this, Martin, is money, of course. A couple of interesting stories. One is that the Brexit hit pound helped the UK boat and yacht industry, notched its highest revenue since the financial crisis. Sterling's collapse, sparked primarily by Brexit jitters, has helped the marine industry rake in £3.12 billion. Last year, they're up something between 3% and 4% on the previous years. But more to the point, Forbes 2017 billionaires list: meet the richest people on the planet. Forbes say it was a record year for the richest people on earth, as the number of billionaires jumped 13% to, there's at least there's some good figures there, to 2,043 from 1,810 last year. First time ever Forbes has pinned down more than 2,010 figure fortunes. Their total net worth rose by 18% to $7.67 trillion, also a record. The change in the number of billionaires, up 233 since 2016, was the biggest in 31 years that Forbes has been tracking billionaires globally.
Crisis, what crisis for the people at the top, eh? The 0.1% are making out like bandits as a result of the bailout of the financial services sector 10 years ago this year. And that's what's going on. The money is being sucked to the top, to these people, through manipulation, financial and government manipulation. And the poor are being ground into the floor in Britain and elsewhere. It's not acceptable, is it?
The man behind your Windows computer, Windows 10, which sort of updates itself. If I was you folks, I'd take your computer back to somebody that knows what they're doing and get Windows 7 put on it, because 10 is an absolute nightmare. As soon as you need to use it, we were in a studio actually trying to record somebody, and it said, no, you can't switch the computer on, and it took about 2 hours for it to actually do its updates and to even switch on. You know, I was, used to think when you turned a TV on back in the old days, the old Valve TVs, and you had to wait half a minute for the screen to come up, that was bad. But, you know, the Windows 10 computers are absolutely appalling. Anyway, Bill Gates, he's the number one richest for the fourth year in a row and the richest person in the world by far. For 18 of the past 23 years. His fortune was last year $75 billion. What do you think it is this year, Martin?
$100 billion?
No, you're overestimating. He's only gone up to $86 billion. So that's actually only $11 billion he's managed to make this year. I don't know quite how he's going to spend all that. Maybe on... how do they spend their money these days?
Well, they create foundations to do good and give their money away. And they also... You know,
to little radio shows like ours?
Well, no. they use their money as a means of political influence. Somebody like Rupert Murdoch doesn't need another red cent. He's super wealthy, but of course, what his money gives him is the power to make and break governments. And of course, that's what we're really talking about here. Money is power, and that's what they're really after. Bill Gates, you have to listen to Bill Gates. When Bill Gates opens his mouth, everybody has to go, yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir.
I noticed we've seen a sort of film of the Queen, quite a lot of that on the TV more recently. It's almost like she seems to be using her royal charter powers at the BBC to say, well, you know, let's have a load stuff about me on here.
Well, yes, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the rigging of stock markets and quantitative easing all over the world has been a win-win for the wealthy classes. So the government's intervention, they're not against government intervention as long as it's helping them. And that's effectively what's happened.
At the other end of the scale, at least the Mirror this week is telling us 13,000 heroic soldiers have been left homeless after leaving the military, and almost all have PTSD. A Sunday People probe reveals how hundreds of British veterans are reduced to sleeping in doorways and begging from passers-by, and then probably being arrested by Bristol City Council's litter police or some similar person. Military charity said the shameful figure is a record high and the government is failing those who risk their lives for Queen and country. 13,000, Martin.
Well, it's hardly surprising, is it? We know what goes on. And this is the world we live in.
That's a division, a couple of divisions there, maybe. Maybe they could be gotten together and do something about their plight.
Well, I saw that there's an SAS guy that was involved in the Iranian embassy siege who's been made homeless, and in fact the SAS are paying for him to have a bed and breakfast accommodation. And of course it's not just ex-military people who are homeless. Universal Credit, which we didn't mention in the first hour, is basically a homelessness machine, because private sector landlords won't rent to people on Universal Credit, which is why they've been unable to roll it out, even in years and years and years of attempting to roll it out. Because it's basically a sentence of homelessness on anybody who's put on it. And, of course, that's been obvious from the get-go, but the government has never taken any notice of that, and they're just proceeding blithely on with the policy of they won't pay landlords directly, as they used to do on housing benefit, and on that basis the private sector won't house people. It's just a deliberate own goal.
Well, when many of these soldiers would have served in Northern Ireland, I would say possibly even the majority of them, and so this is a subject that came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday too.
Mr. David Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister will be aware that Northern Ireland has not had a government now for over a year. Decisions need to be taken to protect our health service, education and local communities. Does the Prime Minister agree that in the absence of a government being formed, it is imperative that her government takes the decision to appoint direct rule ministers as soon as possible so that a budget can be put forward to deal with this urgent problem?
We are committed to re-establishing a fully functioning, inclusive, devolved administration that works for everyone in Northern Ireland. I don't underestimate the challenges that remain involved here, but we still believe that a way forward can be found and an agreement can be reached. And I would say it's imperative, therefore, that the parties re-engage in intensive discussions aimed at resolving the outstanding issues so that the Assembly can meet and an executive can be formed. We do recognise, however, that we have a responsibility to ensure political stability and good governance in Northern Ireland. Obviously, as I say, our priority is on ensuring that we can work with the parties to re-establish the devolved government in Northern Ireland. But we recognise the need to ensure that Northern Ireland can continue to operate and that public services can continue to be provided.
Well, I mean, obviously, as has just been pointed out, there hasn't been a devolved administration for over a year in Northern Ireland.
This is back to direct rule, isn't it? Which is effectively a failure that was that had to be instituted during the Troubles.
Yes, but I mean, one of the things that may be going on here from Sinn Féin's side is that they don't want to carry out a cuts policy. And therefore, if there's direct rule, it'll be the British government based in London which is carrying out cuts in Northern Ireland, and Sinn Féin are simply going to oppose them.
Well, they could oppose them from within government, surely.
Yeah, but then they'd be in the same position as
that's
Marvin.
A bit like Labour Party.
They would be in the same position as Marvin Rees here in Bristol.
Yeah, it's a bit like the Labour Party not putting up a candidate in Bristol, isn't it? Because they didn't want to do cuts.
No, well, I mean, the point about Sinn Féin is they're in a different position. They don't take their seats in the British Parliament. If they did take their seats in the British Parliament, of course, that would completely change the arithmetic on Brexit, for example.
Yes, have a think about that, Sinn Féin, please.
Well, they're not going to, because
the DUP angle here as well, of course, because DUP are actually keeping Theresa May in Downing Street.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, Irish politics are central to British politics. The Irish question is still the question, as it was in the 19th century.
So is Theresa May not going to institute back the Northern Ireland Assembly because the DUP are telling her not to?
I'm not quite sure what's going on there. If both sides in Northern Ireland can agree to form an administration, that's probably the best thing for all concerned. But there's no reason particularly why Sinn Féin should help out the DUP and Theresa May. Let's have direct rule, and then you can cut libraries, schools and hospitals, and we're just going to oppose you.
Okay, we're going to go a little bit more deeply into Northern Ireland now and into some of the history there, because there was military intelligence units over there which were being used by the military to undermine Harold Wilson, Martin, weren't there, back in the 1970s?
Well, that's right, because they were engaged in psychological warfare operations inside Northern Ireland, but they were also engaged in psychological warfare operations against the Labour government. And in fact, the election of a Tory government in the early 1970s probably prolonged the conflict by enormously, because the possibility of a Labour government basically taking a hard line with the Unionists was undermined by the British Army at that stage, because they were basically privately educated Tories.
Weren't some of the people in the British Army actually, didn't they rather like the Troubles because it gave them a kind of live exercise?
Well, exactly. So it was a great for training and all the rest of it, and they can then start planning the sort of thing that they wanted to do in Britain as a whole
and other parts of the world possibly. Indeed. I mean, it was one of the first big sort of sectarian conflicts, which was blamed on religion, wasn't it? Blamed on the Protestants and the Catholics. Actually, there was much more to it to that.
Well, that there were various dimensions to the conflict, and there still are.
Well, you could also look at it as a sort of parallel with the Shia Sunni thing that's been going on in the Middle East.
Well, you could, and the fact of the matter is that this kind of thing has been going on. You know, the British did have an empire. I mean, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is because of the British Empire. The fighting in Sri Lanka between Tamils and Sinhalese, that's the British Empire. The fact that India and Pakistan are still at daggers drawn and they've both got nuclear weapons, that's the British Empire.
And if you actually look around the world, you'll see
that most conflicts, virtually all conflicts around the world, the British Empire was at the root of them.
Divide and rule. So who was Colin Wallis?
Colin Wallis was an army intelligence officer who was involved in psychological warfare operations in Northern Ireland, and then he eventually blew the whistle because the psychological warfare operations that he was involved in were basically involved with undermining the Labour government in Britain. So far from being the intelligence services being a tool of the government, they were being used against the Labour government. And of course, they weren't being used against Tory governments because they're basically Tories. And you've got to recognise that we don't live in a fully functioning democracy when the secret agencies of the state are in fact engaged in political chicanery of this kind.
But he was also approached by somebody because they thought he was a decent guy from the Kinkora boys' home as a whistleblower.
That's right. And of course, King Cora is a key issue. And I think we're going to discuss it now. But of course, it wasn't just in Northern Ireland that children's homes were being used by elite paedophiles, and therefore allowed the intelligence services to use them as means of blackmail on various politicians.
Okay, so before we hear from Colin, do you think that was really what it was about, political blackmail?
Yes, I mean, the intelligence services have this phrase, mice, money, ideology, coercion, ego. And of course, coercion involves where you basically engineer somebody to have sex with an underage person, and then you video it or photograph it, and then those people are blackmailable, and that's why they do it.
Okay, well, let's hear the BBC interview from about 20 years ago now, a little excerpt from this chat with Colin Wallace, and you might find some of this disturbing. It also might be an idea to make sure young children aren't listening.
In 1972, I received a phone call from a social worker, and she said she had some information for the security forces, and arranged to meet me. And I can remember the woman fairly clearly, slightly plump, round face. I can remember she was wearing glasses with fairly large spectacle frames. She told me that she had been involved in the supervision of one particular boy from West Belfast who claimed to have been sexually abused at the Kincora boys home in Belfast. She said that she and her colleagues had raised the matter with the authorities, but nothing had been done. The basic story was that boys in the home were being abused, but also boys from the home were taken out or went out to pre-arranged meetings with individuals in the surrounding area. And the main reason that we were interested was that there were strong links with the loyalist paramilitary community, particularly in East Belfast. I was surprised that, bearing in mind the nature of the allegations, and particularly bearing in mind the fact that we had good working relationships with the RUC, that nothing had been done a year later. And I wrote a fairly strongly worded memo highlighting my concern about the lack of any activity in that respect. I think, too, first of all, I felt very frustrated that nothing had happened. And the fact that children were being abused when they were in the care of the authorities seemed particularly horrific.
In fact, systematic sex abuse at Kincora would continue unchallenged for another 6 years. Significantly, it would later emerge that the loyalist paramilitary leader who ran the home was also working for MI5. After sending his angry memo, Colin Wallace, who had been promoted just weeks earlier, suddenly found himself a very unpopular man.
After I had written the memo about Kincora, and after I had decided not to go ahead with Clockwork Orange, I felt life would settle down and I could get back into much more of my traditional form of working. But suddenly, out of the blue, without any warning, David McDine, the Chief Information Officer at Northern Ireland, told me that I had been requested to go to Minister Defence as a matter of urgency just before Christmas. And in fact, the only time that I could manage to do it comfortably was on Christmas Eve, which was really the beginning of my holiday. So I travelled to Minister Defence main building, and it was a strange and quite hostile interview, which I didn't expect. Very brisk. I was summoned to his office. He said quite bluntly, after a pleasantry, that they had information that my life was in danger and that I was being moved out of Northern Ireland as a matter of urgency.
Yeah, well, he mentioned the Clockwork Orange, and of course that was the code name for the attempt to basically undermine the then Labour government.
But it wasn't an attempt, it worked.
Mm, yeah, it did. Wilson resigned, and eventually the government was forced out. And of course, that sort of thing still goes on. And of course, boys from Kincora weren't just abused at Kincora; they were also then taken off to be to London and other places. And it's not, and in Northern Ireland, this Kincora affair is pretty well known. But of course, the suspicion is that other places like Haute La Garenne in Jersey were also being used in a similar way by the intelligence services to entrap and blackmail politicians. And I'm afraid there's a very dark underbelly to British imperialism, and it's always been there.
Now, two original panel members of the government's child abuse inquiry. This is the one that's just being run now by Alexis Jay. I think she's the third or fourth chair. Mm-hmm. She's the one that found no police and no social workers were guilty up in Rotherham, if you remember her. So they've obviously brought her in to control this inquiry. Two panel members of the government's child abuse inquiry said they were forced to fight attempts at political control interference from the Home Office when it was run by Theresa May. The pair said they wanted to speak out to warn potential members of supposedly independent teams being assembled at the orders of the Prime Minister to investigate Grenfell Tower fire. Sharon Evans and Graham Wilmer revealed how government officials intervened with the independent panel members by preparing a 23-page document instructing them how to answer questions from MPs. Now, these sorts of inquiries, like this child sex abuse inquiry, which we've now heard that various groups say is not fit for purpose, it's been going on for several years. It was started by Theresa May, and they were I remember seeing a few months ago that they still hadn't heard any evidence, which is quite incredible. It doesn't seem as if they're going to get to the bottom of this, does it?
Well, British inquiries are not regarded internationally as free and fair and independent. And the Pat Finucane Centre, based in Northern Ireland, but named after Pat Finucane, who was assassinated by loyalist paramilitaries working with the British state forces, have always called for a full inquiry into collusion between the security forces and the loyalist paramilitary murder campaign over decades, but they don't want a British inquiry because British inquiries are just not independent. But what inquiries are for in Britain is to kick something into the long grass. And at one stage, of course, Kinkora wasn't going to be included in the investigation of child sex abuse in Britain on the grounds, which I find rather amusing, that it wasn't part of British jurisdiction, which is exactly what the conflict's been about for years and years and years, whether it is or isn't part of British jurisdiction.
So are they right? It's not fit for purpose, this child sex abuse inquiry?
I think the same is true of the Grenfell Tower inquiry. These are British inquiries which are controlled by the executive rather than by the judiciary.
So what we're implying here is that even the Kinkora people behind that, the criminals behind that, and plenty of other basically kids who were taken into care and then just farmed out to paedophiles, that they won't be brought to justice. That worries me. And also this week we hear that there's a great enthusiasm for unaccompanied minors at Calais to be given help to come to Britain and go to children's homes here.
Well, I mean, that's another story and another issue. I think that the child...
I mean, have we got a safe environment for children to be taken into care homes in Britain at the moment?
I think the majority of people working in care homes are the genuine people who are doing a genuine job and trying to help. But the fact is, as Kinkora shows, the intelligence services abuse and manipulate young people as part of their psychological warfare techniques, and it's been going on for years. And will there be a full inquiry into all of this? I very much doubt it. Ultimately, what you're probably going to have in Northern Ireland is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where if people come forward and say what they were involved in, then they're not subject to prosecution.
But what I'm saying is it the right time for Theresa May, as she's done, to announce UK will accept more child refugees who are unaccompanied from Calais? Just seems to me that we need to get our house in order before we do that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter, if you've got child refugees at Calais who are under the age of 16 and nobody to help them, then something's going to have to be done about that, whatever.
Maybe the French, this isn't just kicking the blame over to France, but it might be that the French care system is more appropriate than the British care system.
Well, I suspect that what's going on is intelligence services, Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence services have been doing this all along, and not just in Northern Ireland.
But it's not just them, surely. Paedophiles too, ordinary paedophiles.
Well, yes, but the real problem with the VIP paedophilia is that in actual fact it's the use of paedophilia as a tool of psychological warfare. There's always been a problem with paedophilia in the Catholic Church, in Boy Scouts, whatever. But the use of paedophilia as a political tool by the intelligence services is truly sinister.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to this interview with Paul Williams, former CIA agent, who spoke to Sean Stone on Watching the Hawks, RT America, about the Gulen movement, who was supposedly behind the coup attempt, 18 months ago in Turkey.
The CIA was funding this operation. Not only this operation, and that explains it, why they could persist day after day, night after night, training these people to become jihadis and to fight over there.
Right.
Without taking action against them. Because the FBI, and I worked for the FBI for years, mm-hmm. did anything about it.
But so, when you broke this story in Islamberg, and obviously you say 35 other camps, training camps for militants that are going on here, when you would approach, let's say, for the official story from FBI or CIA, what story would they give you as to why these camps were allowed to operate without being raided?
They couldn't explain it. There was absolutely no explanation. And once again, I had contacts in the FBI. I worked for the FBI. I was paid by the FBI mm-hmm. for 10 years. Now, the second thing I found, when I started looking into a guy by the name of Fethullah Gulen. Now, you and I are very much interested in Gladio, and you know how strategic Gulen is to the entire Gladio, too. Gulen has a compound in Sellersburg, Pennsylvania, less than an hour from where we're sitting, about 40 minutes from my house. Well, I went up there as well. At his compound in Sellersburg, it was very similar to what was going on in Islamberg. They were training, doing paramilitary training. They were armed to the teeth. They were all coming in from Turkey. The neighbors had complained, and nothing was done. Mm-hmm. Nothing was ever done. They talked. The neighbors were complaining about the helicopters flying around their properties for surveillance night and day. They complained about the explosions going on in the property, the sound of gunfire and of AK-47s. Nothing was done. So then I discovered, now this was really, really, really what dropped the scales from my eyes. Gulen, when he applied for his permanent residency in the United States, he was thrown out of Turkey, as you know, for trying to overthrow the Turkish government. This is going back to 1998. He was thrown out of Turkey, and just like Gilani, he's transported. This is the guy called the most radical, most dangerous Muslim in the world. Transported from Turkey to Washington, D.C. originally on a CIA transport. I discovered that, and I figured, this is insane. Mm-hmm. This is insane. And the next thing I find out is the camp that he had at Sellersburg was once again backed by the CIA. And his movement, his Islamic schools throughout the country, throughout the world, as you know, and in all the schools in Central Asia are CIA agents.
So that's Paul Williams there speaking to Sean Stone, Martin.
Yeah, and I think Gladio 2, which you mentioned there, people can do a web search to look into that. Sybil Edmonds, who used to work for the FBI and is of Turkish origin, she's written quite extensively about Gladio 2. And people need to realise that Western intelligence services, for years, have been running and orchestrating Islamist terrorism.
The big question, of course, is Gladio 2 operating now in Britain?
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt about it. This is what's going on. British Special Forces have been in Syria, probably still are in Syria, working with Al-Qaeda. And it's not something that used to happen and we stopped doing it. We're still doing it.
The police have told us that there are hundreds of these jihadis, apparently from Syria, that have come back to Britain now, but none of them has been interviewed at the airport.
Well, that's because they were probably recruited in the first place by Western intelligence services, who then used the Turks, Turkey and Jordan as places where they could be infiltrated into Syria. And I don't think anybody who's looked into this can dispute that the Western intelligence services working with the Saudis are behind jihadi terrorism, both in Syria and elsewhere.
Okay, we'll
that's
up.
Certainly the view of the Iranian, Russian and Chinese general staff.
And also there's all this government report into these training camps here in Britain, not training camps, schools in Britain educating people in Wahhabism, which was suppressed. But anyway, finally, the House of Saud. Have you managed to watch any of those yet?
No.
On Wednesday evenings, I said Fridays last, but it's on Wednesday evenings on BBC. It's been really actually quite powerful, very interesting. And a lot of Andrew Feinstein, who we had on this show, I think 6 years ago, interviewing him about Al-Yamamah and various other dodgy arms deals, which Tony Blair, your precious Tony Blair, stopped the inquiry into the corruption there.
Well, he's not my Tony Blair, Tony.
Well, he's in your party.
He's got the same name as you, Tony. I think that's much more important.
He's the former leader of your party.
Well, of course, and if he is very much a puppet of bigger forces, and that's why he's not leading it anymore.
We'll have to watch the final one. I think it is next week, where they talk a bit more about MBS. But it does look as if they're saying, "Oh well, this corruption is over, going to be over with now. This new guy's arrived,"
which of course is just a whitewash. MBS is as evil as anything that's ever come out of the Saudi regime. And the Saudi regime are our close allies. Their chaps are all trained at Sandhurst. We have got British military personnel in Saudi Arabia now helping to force the biggest cholera epidemic in history on the poor people of Yemen. And we're doing that, and that's what our taxes get spent on, not helping the homeless on the streets of Bristol.
One very sad event this week was the death of Peter Wingard. I think he was one of the greatest actors at stage and screen. Fantastic. Also, we'll definitely have a clip of him next week, our final show, which starts at 5 and finishes at 7. And so that's time now to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi up next. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Secretary of Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, Matthew Carey, and leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Eleanor Comley. And also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday. This show, though, the story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk, where you'll find some details of how you can write to the station manager, Pat Hart, about whether you think that this show should start at 5 or 6. Anyway, you'll find me on Twitter in the meantime at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from Bill Withers. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. And I know, 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 I know. I know, hey, I ought to leave the young thing alone, but ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Only darkness every day. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.